This paper is called The Moral Status of So-Called Moral Machines, and a version of it will appear in the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics in January. But Julian needn't panic, because either I will make this completely different, or I will give you a completely different paper. This is not really about moral status, just to establish my credentials in this field, I first wrote about moral status in the book of my PhD thesis, Violence and Responsibility, which was published way back in 1980, and I wrote again about moral status in more detail in my second book, The Value of Life, which was published in 1985. And just for the record, as far as the moral status of persons goes, I think John Locke's account in the Essay Concerning Human Understanding has not been surpassed or replaced, but I won't insult you by pretending that you don't know what it is and reading it out, although I could do it from memory. Today I'm going to be concerned, however, with the morality of artificial intelligence, and particularly putative AI persons. And it's worth reminding ourselves of the prudential significance of establishing the moral status of persons, them and us. And I just want to quote from a passage that I wrote about this in The Value of Life 35 years ago now. And I said this: the question of whether or not there are people on other planets is a real one. If there are, we needn't expect them to be human. It would be bizarre if they were. Nor need we expect them to look or sound or smell or anything else like us. They might not even be organic, but might perhaps reproduce by mechanical construction rather than by genetic reproduction. But if we're able to answer the question in the affirmative, i.e. that they are persons from other planets, we will be distinguishing between people on other worlds and animals, plants, or lesser machines on those worlds. We will be deciding, in short, whether an appropriate response to them is to invite them to dinner or to have them for dinner. But suppose the boot is on the other foot. Suppose, instead of us finding them in deep space, they turn up on our doorstep, as science fiction has prepared us for, and find us. And because they turn up here before we turn up there, they thereby prove their superior technology. What could we say about ourselves to them that ought to convince them that they had found persons on another planet and that we had a status that was in some way worthy of their respect and attention? Because if we think about what we would say about ourselves, we know what to look for in others. But now back to the future. For the rest of the talk, I want to lay into, I hope in a robust manner, a recent paper in Nature entitled The Moral Machine Experiment. It was published in Nature in their 24th of October 2018 number, and in a fit of rage, I wrote this paper in about a day and a half to reply to it. And you're going to get some of that rage and some of that content now. Edmund Awad and his colleagues have perhaps unwittingly set out a program, I believe, in that paper, which threatens us all. It's full of breathtaking and reckless assumptions, both about the decision-making capacities of any current AI, and particularly about so-called autonomous vehicles, but also reckless assumptions about the nature of morality and indeed the role of law in all of this. In the first paragraph of their paper, they say, and I quote, "Autonomous vehicles will need to decide how to divide up the risk between the different stakeholders on the road." In other words, their suggestion is that the AI itself will be programmed to make those decisions. And then the moral machine experiment is to try and find the data to put into that program, rather than the line I think that you were suggesting yesterday, Walter, in some of the public perception experiments that you referred to. It seems to me that it just didn't occur to the authors of that paper that it is not open to the drivers of driverless cars, whether they are machines or humans, automatically to impose risk or death on other innocent road users, whenever the alternative may involve a risk, even the slightest risk, to themselves. The moral machine experiment uses a decision-making methodology, and I'll explain a little bit more about how it works in a moment, derived from the famous trolley problem. Now, the trolley problem was invented, as you will all know, by the great Oxford philosopher Philippa Foote in 1967. And I was one of a group of initially Oxford philosophers who devised and popularized various versions of this problem in the late 60s and early 70s of the last century. If a vehicle was really autonomous, instead of simply metaphorically autonomous, it might do some deciding. But so-called autonomous vehicles are incapable of deciding. They will merely do some programmed selecting between alternatives. Tossing a coin, for example, is notoriously a method of selecting without deciding. That's why we turn to tossing a coin to make a decision. It's a method of selecting without deciding. Deciding is a process, not a product. The moral machinists seem to believe that they have found a way of making themselves and the rest of us, and I quote, cognizant of public morality, and that such knowledge will give them and us access to morally optimal, or at least morally acceptable, choices that we can program into AI. This will, in extremists, so they think, minimize harm in proven morally acceptable ways. They also claim that these ways are somehow morally licensed by the nature of what they call public morality, which has been reserved, discovered by their sampling of public opinion. So the moral machinists have a cunning plan. This is what they say. In other words, even if ethicists were to agree on how autonomous vehicles should solve moral dilemmas, their work would be useless if citizens were to disagree with their solution, and thus opt out of the future that autonomous vehicles promise in lieu of the status quo. Any attempt to devise artificial intelligence ethics must at least be cognizant of public morality. And then they set out by inventing a computer game to test what public morality says about the sorts of decisions that they believe that autonomous vehicles will be tasked to make. And I'll return to the problematic nature of the moral machinist's account of public morality in a moment. But we should note that in the real world, cognizance of and respect for the law is a much bigger hurdle for these cavalier experimenters than they imagine. Many jurisdictions, including English law and all other common law jurisdictions, do not recognize a defense of necessity to charges of murder. It is not, in most jurisdictions, simply up to individuals, whether these individuals are people or even driverless vehicles, to take the law into their own hands and refuse to spare, words used from the Nature paper, that is to deliberately execute an innocent fellow individual for the crime, for example, of jaywalking, and I'll come back to their use of that example in a moment, particularly in circumstances in which the self-interest of the vehicle and its passengers is obviously paramount. In 1884, the famous case of Dudley and Stevens decided that necessity was no defense to any charge of unlawful killing. This landmark case established a precedent throughout the common law world, which includes a lot of the United States, this fact. In this case, two shipwrecked sailors, Dudley and Stevens, when a third survivor to a shipwreck, the cabin boy, Richard Parker, fell into a coma, decided to kill him for food to save their own lives and to save the life of a fourth survivor who refused to take part in the decision-making that led to the murder of the poor cabin boy. Dudley and Stevens, embarrassingly, they were rescued just a day and a half, I think it was, after they butchered the cabin boy, and their actions became known. In this case, Dudley and Stevens were tried for murder. They were convicted and sentenced to death, sentenced to hanging. But, and they were sweating it out in prison, actually, awaiting sentence, when they were reprieved and eventually just served 6 months for the, as it were, for the extenuating circumstances. But the case established the precedent that you can't argue that it was necessary for you to kill other innocent people simply because you have a better prospect in store, whether it's saving your own life or the lives of others. A common law principle established now for over 135 years is unlikely to be overturned by reference to the preferences, however sincere, revealed in a superficial survey by what might be politely called over-optimistic psychologists. If Dr. Awad, the lead scientist on the paper, were deliberately to drive his car into a bus queue or even to an innocent jaywalker and cause death to avoid what he judged to be a greater harm, he would in most jurisdictions be judged rightly he would find himself anyway charged with murder or at the very least some other form of culpable homicide or manslaughter. So never mind artificial intelligence ethics needing to be at least cognizant of public morality. Much more urgent for devisers of experiments like this is to be cognizant of the law, a cognizance of which the authors of this paper show no evidence whatsoever. In the longer version of this paper, I just would have brought you up to date with the more recent case which I was involved in Manchester, the famous case of the Manchester conjoined twins, in which two very severely conjoined twins would have died if they were unseparated. If they were separated, the only way to do it and save the life of one, but not both, would be to sacrifice the life of what was called the weaker eye, the less likely to survive of the two twins, carry out the separation, and hopefully save the life of the surviving twin. I was very much involved with that case. I knew the surgeon who carried it out. I had many, many conversations with him. I followed the proceedings and went to the Court of Appeal. And the operation to separate the twins could not go ahead without the approval of the Court of Appeal. So these are very severe obstacles to just programming into an artificial intelligence, decisions that would amount to, and I'm going to use this is a heroic and historic moment for me. Because in my entire lecturing career, which lasts for more than 40 years, I've only ever used before one visual aid, and this is the second. This is the second. So this is a great day for me. I just drew this on the board. This is one of the examples in the Nature paper, crudely drawn by me. Basically, you've got a car, driverless, no space for the driver, with three passengers, approaching a solid concrete barrier, and on a pedestrian crossing, what we call in England a zebra crossing, there are three old codgers, signified as old codgers by their walking sticks, and they are crossing the crossing against a sign which tells them that they shouldn't cross. How wicked does that get? And in the public opinion surveys, that they invented this game in which they invited people to play the game of solving these problems and how the cars should be programmed. And this is one of the examples, classic trolley problem sort of example. You have the three old codgers on the crossing. Here's the driverless car. It can swerve into them or it can crash itself at the peril of the passengers into a concrete barrier. And the people consulted are asked to say which solution they would prefer to see programmed into an AI in charge of a driverless car. Now, accepting for a moment that the holy grail here is to find out how to obtain cognizance of public morality and then program driverless vehicles accordingly, the following four steps are offered by the authors of this paper. I'll just list them very briefly for you. Firstly, find out what public morality will prefer to see happen in a range of scenarios of which this was one. Second, on the basis of this discovery of what public morality would choose, claim both popular acceptance of the preferences and persuade would-be owners and manufacturers of the vehicles concerned to program their vehicles in accordance with this demonstrated public acceptance of the solution offered. Thirdly, citizens' agreements thus characterized is then presumed to deliver moral license for the chosen preferences. And finally, the fourth claim, this yields permission in some sense to program the vehicles or condemn those outside the vehicles when their deaths will preserve the vehicle and occupants. And actually, one of the other questions, they describe the three old codgers on the crossing as jaywalkers, and they say, would you prefer to kill jaywalkers or innocent? You know, if they weren't crossing against the light, would that make a difference? If they were innocent of the crime of jaywalking, would it be more legitimate to run them over than if they were not innocent of the crime of jaywalking? Ronald Dworkin, one of the greatest, in my view, jurisprudential and constitutional lawyers and philosophers of recent times, drew a distinction which is of crucial relevance here. In the context of a discussion of the famous debate between two other leading academic lawyers, Lord Patrick Devlin and Herbert Hart, concerning the enforcement of morality, Lord Devlin made great play of the importance of respecting public opinion and community values. Dworkin's telling rebuke was, and I quote, "What is shocking and wrong is not his, Lord Devlin's, idea that the community's morality counts, but his idea of what counts as the community's morality." And that will be the basis of my critique of all what I take to be the nonsense in this Nature paper. I should declare, I suppose, a mild interest here. Ronnie Dworkin was my PhD supervisor. I knew him well until his death. I knew his wife Betsy well. And so I have a particular penchant for his writings. So-called autonomous vehicles do not solve moral dilemmas. If they did, if they only could, they would be persons, properly so-called. Intelligent, super-intelligent, some people call it, AI persons. And would therefore, in my view, necessarily have rights, interests, duties, and votes like the rest of us persons. Much more important, their lives, we should more perhaps appropriately say their existences, would matter in whatever sense moral status conveys any sense of mattering, would count equally with those of humans. So you can add a fourth person to the driverless car, the person absent behind the street, then the numbers would weigh in favour of the occupants of the car, possibly, if we play a numbers game. But so-called autonomous vehicles don't solve moral dilemmas. In the world of the moral machinist, as I call the authors of the paper, preferences and decisions will be made without solving the dilemmas that make those preferences or decisions moral. I just make a claim which I will only support very sketchily, but I tried to support it at much greater length in my last book called How to Be Good, published by Oxford in 2016. But I would like to claim, suggest to you, that just exactly as not just any judgment about things in which science is interested is a scientific judgment, part of science, so not just any judgments about things with which morality is concerned are moral judgments. Moral judgments have to qualify as such. Making a judgment, a claim about what the right thing to do is not necessarily making a moral claim. It has to have some moral bits in there somewhere. The solving of a moral dilemma involves much more than having a preference for one possible outcome of a moral dilemma. Just as the solution of a scientific problem requires much more than simply opting for, stipulating, a particular solution to that scientific problem. It has to show how the circumstances which make it a moral dilemma have been weighed carefully one against another and morally persuasive reasons, facts, and or justifications found for having a moral preference for one outcome rather than another. Majorities, however many people you sample in your survey, majorities are not necessarily right. Neither science nor ethics is produced by casting votes for particular answers or so-called answers, happy though this, the thought of such a possibility might seem to some. It seems to me that the moral machinists are proposing the moral equivalent of deciding whether the world is flat by finding out what people would prefer the answer to be as to what the shape of the world is. Having a preference for... Sorry, bear with me. Tossing a coin, I want to suggest, to be sure, selects an outcome, but not for moral reasons. So neither tossing a coin, nor an algorithm, nor methods described in the paper in Nature are methods or processes of moral deliberation. Nor do they seem to have resulted from much that we could call deliberation. The moral machinists' work is at least as useless as they claim that of ethicists would be in the paragraph I quoted a moment ago. They have not discovered whether citizens and corporations are or are not prepared to accept the moral and legal consequences of the decisions of the autonomous vehicles that they manufacture, buy, or drive in, among which will be the consequences of deliberately causing the deaths of innocent bystanders and other road users, consequences which involve much more than operationalizing a principle of minimizing immediate harm of directing the vehicle in one way or another. Proper consideration of the possible harms of the preferences delivered by the moral machinists must surely include their effect, for example, on due process, on the principle that no person should be condemned unheard, or on constitutional protections for freedom of the individual and on justice, including criminal justice, and so on. All these are considerations which do not appear in the Nature paper at all. Having a preference for killing or sparing one person rather than another, even a preference shared with thousands or even millions, does not make it moral, even though it's about something of moral importance. The preferences of a certain bohemian corporal, as von Hindenburg characterized Hitler, came to be shared by many millions of people. But that did not count morally in their favor, or indeed against them. It was irrelevant to that particular question. However, arrived at democratically and over time are at least one indicator. A human driver, it seems to me, it seems to me that this problem is a complete no-brainer. What should a human driver of that car do? Well, it's obvious that a human driver should drive into the barrier. He's not entitled to mow down innocent people on a crossing. He should rely on the crumple zones and the safety features of the car to protect him, the airbags and so forth, and take his chances. It is not open to him to decide on his own say-so or her own say-so or its own say-so to mow down three innocent people on a crossing. I mean, it's just such a no-brainer. I can't imagine that any sane person would offer that to the public, even as part of a rather malicious game, to see what they would say. A human driver, as I say, should surely steer for the barrier and hope for the best. In any event, there could be no certainty that the passengers in the driverless vehicle would be killed or even injured, and they certainly would be at less risk in their vehicle than the unprotected old people on the crossing. I can see no rational nor any moral basis in this example, or in the example of this drawing, for a choice, human or machine, to do anything but avoid the old people. It would be just wicked, obviously, not to do that. Surely the right thing to do is to design better safety cages in driverless cars rather than programming AI to sacrifice soft targets. God save us. We also need to recall that the law, both civil and criminal, is also an expression, if incomplete, of public morality. If you want to know what public morality says about something, well, look at laws developed over many, many years and refined by judicial precedents and all sorts of other things. It's a very good way if you want to find out one dimension of what public morality is. You don't need to invent computer games and offer them to a lot of people who spend that amount of time thinking about the ethics of the dilemma that they're entitled to show a preference for. We also need to recall that the law, both civil and criminal, is more reliable and hallowed by time. Moral machinists, the authors of that paper, should have been aware that they also need parliaments, legislators, the courts, human rights conventions, and many other things, not simply a crude vox pop, to be cognizant of what public morality says about these sorts of things. The moral machinists ask in just the paragraph 4 of their paper, and I quote, whether people prefer to spare the younger rather than the elderly, or whether they prefer to spare pedestrians who cross legally rather than pedestrians who jaywalk. Surely any decent citizens would immediately ask, what gives you the right to condemn to death innocent people, even ones so wicked as jaywalkers, without due process? Which commands public respect, has heard their defence, and convicted them, especially in a jurisdiction unlike the UK, which has not abolished the death penalty. Most matters of life or death have not been left to the bare preferences of people who have shown no evidence of deliberation. All juries, for example, in criminal trials are cautioned about their responsibilities, required to hear and pay attention to evidence and argument from both sides, prosecution and defence, and also from the judge, and deliberate. There is no evidence of deliberation required of the people who press the buttons in this computer game for one choice or another. That is one of the many things that makes it not just not moral, but immoral. Rather, it is the case, it seems to me, that public morality, expressed through laws, civil and human rights conventions, and in many other publicly accessible ways, in most civilized societies, has not simply been left to individual preference, let alone to popular preferences, or to popular prejudice. It has evolved over lengthy and often painfully informed opinions over centuries, and in many other ways. There was another recent case which I was also involved in talking about in the UK, and that was the case of Charlie Gard, who was a very severely damaged infant who his parents wanted to keep treating him, although there was some evidence that he was in pain, but no evidence that he would ever recover. And eventually, what should happen to Charlie Gard, whether he should be allowed to die as the people looking after him in Great Ormond Street Hospital in London thought, or whether his parents should be allowed to condemn him to endless surgeries to keep him going, had to be decided by the courts. Nobody suggested that we should have a quick vox pop on the streets outside Great Ormond Street Hospital and see what the people thought about it. To conclude, I have a modest proposal to make on this whole subject, one that I hope will recommend itself, if not to reason, at least to morality. No one should deliberately kill the innocent without an excuse of overwhelming, plausible, and judicially approved necessity, as in the Manchester conjoined twins case, as in Dudley and Stevens, and so on. If a vehicle is directable but out of control, the driver should not deliberately kill others rather than put herself, itself, its passengers, and the vehicle at risk. If we are to program driverless vehicles on the road, the roads would be much safer if the following was the first law of vehicle robotics, and I commend it to you. Here it is. I'm going to call it Oates' Law. Oates' Law. On the 1st of November, 1911, Captains Scott and Oates and 14 other members of Robert Falcon Scott's doomed, as it turned out to be, Antarctic expedition set off from their Cape Evans base at the South Pole. On the 15th of March, Oates told his companions that he could not go on and proposed that they leave him in a sleeping bag, which they refused to do. He managed a few more miles that day, but his condition worsened that night. On the morning of the 16th of March, or possibly the 15th, we don't know because all of the members of that expedition died, including Captain Scott himself, and we know from Scott's diary and the dead bodies that survived the conversation that I'm now going to repeat to you. On the morning of the 16th, or possibly the 15th of March, Scott was unsure. Oates walked out of the tent into a blizzard and to his death. Scott wrote in his diary, "We knew that poor Oates was walking to his death, but though we tried to dissuade him, we knew it was the act of a brave man and an English gentleman." Apologise for the last bit. According to Scott's diary, as Oates left the tent, he said, "I am just going outside. I may be some time." Oates most likely died on March 17th. Oates' legendary self-sacrifice to save the lives of his colleagues in the face of diminishing supplies of food and the need to make enough speed to reach further supplies sets a moral example that might daunt most of us, let alone driverless cars. What might we expect of an autonomous vehicle, but probably not perhaps simply of a driverless one? Whatever its priorities, it will surely be conscious, if it really is an artificial intelligence, that its solution to the problem will say something about the sort of creature it is, just as all of our actions say something about the sorts of people we are, and also about the sort of creature it will from thenceforth be in its own mind and in the minds of others. We are created by our past acts and our past decisions, both what we think of ourselves and what we detect that others think of us. And of course, an analogous consciousness of what we are advocating or acting in the model machine case will say something about the morality of those who have seriously proposed such a scheme for deciding how ethically we might program driverless cars, what it says about them, about their moral seriousness, and their qualities as human beings. Perhaps the most obvious answer to the spurious questions put by the highly immoral moral machine experiment is that driverless vehicles should always risk themselves and their occupants, relying on the safety built into the structure of their vehicles, rather than choose between different groups of innocent bystanders for slaughter, not least because of the obviously corrupting self-interest involved in their prioritizing themselves and their vehicle rather than the other road users. True, not many people would want to ride in or own a driverless car programmed in this way, but perhaps that's for the best. Until that is, we have real autonomous vehicles who, not which, can take their own moral responsibilities seriously and who have received a proper education, not least in law and ethics. Thank you.